Jim is a stay-at-home dad.
We'll open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Wednesday, February 6, 2013, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And we have no committee bills, right, that we're introducing? Okay, so we're going to move on to the informational meeting, the overview of human services. So Erin Kelly Seal, who is the director of the Department of Human Services. Welcome, Erin.
So here's the text of...
Great. And I think we all have... You'll be doing the... PowerPoint, and we also, I think we have paper copies of it too if you need.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm the director of the Department of Human Services. I am looking forward to what will, I think, be the start of a long and meaningful relationship this session with our organization. I know this committee has a lot of issues it will be considering, and many of those relate back to the core mission of our organization. So I appreciate the time that the chair is giving today just to do a high-level overview. As I understand it, the goals for today are for me to be pretty high level and get a sense of interest in particular areas and make sure that we're all on the same page about where the department has been the last few years since we've been working with several of you, and then also where we're going. So you have in your materials a PowerPoint that I promise not to belabor too much, as well as a two-pager front and back that talks about some of the strategic initiatives the department's working on, so I'm going to cover those things. I thought it would be important just to recognize that when last you were in your full session in 2011, DHS was actually a bigger organization than we are now. You passed legislation in 2009 that created the Oregon Health Authority. And starting on July 1, 2011, the Department of Human Services began to reset around its core values, its mission, and the programs that remained within our organization. And I'll go into that here. Most importantly, I want you all to appreciate that we are, I believe, still the state's largest agency. We have around, on any given moment, between 7,500 and 8,000 employees. And we have what we believe is a very important mission around helping Oregonians reach their full potential. And we serve lots of people. I'll talk more about that. And we have core values that we ask all of our staff to embrace and exemplify in their work. And as we became a new DHS with the split from the Oregon Health Authority, we re-examined those core values. And I highlight them for you here because they will segue into part of my overarching message. We added the core values of innovation and service equity to our list of core values as an agency really intentionally. We have been spending a lot of time on our data and recognizing that we do serve the entire state of Oregon. Our state has many diverse needs, whether those are urban-rural, whether those are surrounding different communities, people with disabilities, people with different abilities, people of color. And our data demonstrates the need for us to be really intentional about that work and to seek and to really strive for service equity. And so that's what that value is about, core value is about. Also, the value, core value of innovation. As a business, like many organizations, we are needing to do a lot of thinking about what we consider to be the new normal, a time where the demand for service is increasing, the expectations that are upon government are increasing, and the level of resource available to serve people is either flat or declining, depending on your perspective, over the last biennium. And we believe that it's really an important time to be open to new ideas and to be thinking about not just where we are, but where we're going going into the future, and that's why we adopted also the core value around innovation. The people that work with me are some of the best and brightest, and I truly believe in their passion for the people that they serve, and they are people who often have really amazing ideas about how to improve that service, and we want to encourage that within the organization in partnership with those who support that service delivery. So this is an organizational chart for us. Again, I don't want to belabor it. What I want to highlight are the five major program areas that I am responsible for, that our department is responsible for. We serve children and adults with developmental disabilities, and we just recently announced the hire of our new director in that program area. Her name is Patrice Spotsford. I'm sure you all will get to hear from her. We provide long-term care services as well as other prevention-oriented services for seniors and adults with disabilities in our aging and people with disabilities group. We have the child welfare programs, and so we have the statutory responsibility for difficult circumstances when children are abused or neglected. We have a group of programs which we refer to as self-sufficiency programs. Those are programs really tailored around meeting people's basic needs, food, shelter, and there's a high degree of emphasis in that program area around employment. And employment is also a focus for our vocational rehabilitation service area, which specializes in the employment of people with disabilities. So those are our five main program areas, and what you can see here is that we depend, we do some of the direct service delivery, which if you look at that left-hand column, that's what that column is intended to depict, and we also depend on others in each program area to deliver services directly to clients. And I see that there's a question.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming today, Erin. The Vocational Rehabilitation Program, is it intended to serve both adults with physical disabilities and adults with developmental disabilities? And beyond the intention, is that what is occurring?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, yes, it is intended to serve all people with all disability types. And yes, when we make a presentation for you about those services, we'd be happy to give you more detail, or we can provide it offline as well around the types of which disability groups are being served and in what proportion. And yes, people with developmental disabilities are being served by Voc Rehab right now. That being said, we have areas for improvement there that we have identified and are working on.
And just a brief follow-up. So if we have constituents that are taking their teenage students to get Voc Rehab services, or schools are inviting Voc Rehab to participate, and they're being told that they don't serve people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, I could tell those constituents that Erin said no, their mission is to serve adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and they cannot be turned away on the basis of that disability.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, you can tell them that Erin said that they cannot be turned away on the basis of their disability.
Thank you.
And maybe we can have a further hearing on this issue later.
Thank you.
So one of the things I just would like to highlight here are that, you know, is the fact that we partner with counties, with community partners around quite a bit of service delivery, although we are large. And I'll talk a little bit about the breakdown of that, but particularly in the areas of developmental disability services and in aging services, we have special partner relationships with counties, local governments, with nonprofits to provide services. But also, even in the area, let's say, of child welfare, we don't directly provide mental health services or even directly provide the foster care services that children in the child welfare system receive. We provide case management eligibility services. So we can't be successful without strong partnerships with community partners, providers, and the people that we're serving. On the operational side, the reason that picture here is so much larger for you is simply to highlight for many people who are more familiar with who we are that we did a pretty large reset internally when we became our own organization. I'll show you a slide in a moment, but on average, our department When you look at our budget, only 5% of our budget is spent on administration. And so for such a large agency, that's a very small percentage. And the percentage, what that means is we have to be very efficient, very effective with the administrative supports that we have. And when we went through the process of looking at the outcomes that we have as an enterprise, so what are the things we're trying to achieve for people, we identified that in each of our program areas, we had bodies of work that were very, very similar and also very, very stretched. And so we consolidated those bodies of work, licensing, for example, adult prevention and protective services, for example, so that we could leverage the resources that we have across programs. And it's demanding of us some different relationships between the program support offices, which is what we call them, and our programs. But we've actually seen quite a bit of growth and benefit from that. We serve a lot of people. I'm so sorry.
Yes.
Director, I'm sorry. The numbers beside brokerage, is that the number of FTEs? What is that number beside on the left-hand side?
That is the number, Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, that is the number of brokerages that currently we contract with in operation. So those are nonprofit organizations. That's not the number of FTE.
No FTE.
Okay, thank you.
This slide, I won't go through in detail, but it's designed to really illustrate the scope of service that we deliver with our department. We serve over 1 million people annually with food, medical coverage, cash assistance that helps support people to stay in their own homes and maintain their family stability. We obviously provide quite a bit of service to seniors, people with disabilities, child protective services, adoption services, domestic violence services, services to people with developmental disabilities. So there is a large, we have a large impact, not just directly with regard to our customers, our consumers, those who receive our services, but we also impact communities pretty significantly with the financial investment that we make in them and with the support that we provide to people and providers. 77% or so of our budget goes out the door in the form of payments directly to clients, like a food stamp benefit that helps feed their families, or payments to providers. We generate about $9.8 million of economic activity a day in the state of Oregon through those payments.
Again, that amount again?
$9.8 million a day is the amount of sort of economic transaction that comes from us to providers of service and in the form of benefits to people in the state. We leverage quite a bit of federal funding. Almost 70% of our budget comes from the federal government, $6 billion. And we actually support employment, a significant number of jobs in the community. This highlights some of the jobs that we help create. I can share with you, this committee in its past has spent, and I think this time will as well, spend quite a bit of time, for example, on the temporary assistance for needy family programs. We contract for job support services in those programs for clients, and when that budget was reduced by 50% last biennium, over 320 jobs were lost because of that budget reduction. As you might imagine, the last 4 years for our organization have been significant in terms of the impact of the economic recession. Many of our programs, not all, but many of them do depend on the level of an individual's income for people to qualify. And as more and more people have struggled to just meet their family's basic needs, more and more people have qualified for service and have been coming in our doors. We recognize that the unemployment rate across the state varies greatly depending on where you live, we also have, even so, what we've seen in the last 4 years in terms of the impact on our service is a significant increase in demand for service, and that has put extraordinary pressure at a time when the budget for the state and for those services has been really stretched. We've experienced program reductions, staffing reductions at the same time that the demand for our service is increasing. Ultimately, for many of our programs, again, not all, some of our programs, like developmental disability services, are lifespan programs, but for many of our programs, the ultimate result we hope to achieve is to be able to help people to get on their feet and to be able to transition off of the program. And that's been extraordinarily challenging for us in this difficult economic time. And it's, more importantly, extraordinarily challenging for Oregonians.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The you know, it's understandable why SNAP and TANF and Oregon Health Plan numbers would have increased so much because of the recession. Medicare, we have more boomers. Can you explain the developmental disabilities increase?
Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, if my memory serves, and we may need to have someone correct me on this, we're averaging about 90 new people enrolling in developmental disability services every month, most of whom, about 60% of whom, are children. We certainly have been looking really closely at the impact autism has on that caseload. Developmental disability services are voluntary, and they're not income dependent. And the system has undergone over the last two decades significant change in terms of our ability to better support people in communities before they get to the point of crisis. But we still have a long way to go in that arena, particularly for 18 to 26 year olds. And so the point in time that most services to people with developmental disabilities are actually supported by their families, and that's been an important dynamic for us as we have struggled and tried to stretch particularly our support for families with children, and as we struggled around that transition age to provide adequate supports. So I think there probably are others who are more expert who could talk to you a little bit more about the drivers of that caseload growth, but that's kind of my high-level knowledge of, you know, people. I think families have been more stretched financially the last few years, and I think autism is contributing. And I know that Representative Gelser is very expert in this area and probably could support my answer with some other observations as well. But does that ring true for you?
Madam Chair, a lot of that rings true. I think one of the pieces is as SPD has tried to serve more kids, especially in the family support program, they've reduced the benefit to families. So there are kind of smaller family support plans throughout the year. So for years, we've had, I know when I worked for SPD and managed that program, we had over 2,000 children waiting to be able to receive any service, any type of in-home support, any type of respite care. And the result of that is a couple hundred kids with developmental disabilities a year that are voluntarily placed in foster care, mm-hmm. not due to abuse or neglect, but because the families can't access respite or help to lift or bathe their children. And then those kids end up going into 24-hour comprehensive services. Or we have 58 Oregon kids living in nursing homes right now. And what is it? Only two of the 58 have a discharge plan to kind of leave. So it's a complicated system, and I think it's probably not so much an increase in the need, but an increase in the number served of a huge backlog of need.
Madam Chair.
Yes, let's be Gallegos.
These numbers reflect sort of an increase in need out there, but one of the things that we constantly heard on the doors this summer was issues around schools and the increase in class sizes, the decrease in numbers of school days, all those kinds of horror stories about school funding. And one of the things that I thought about, though, is the whole issue of not just the schools, but the caseloads that workers are having to deal with. You know, expanding caseloads that would then impair, let's say, the ability of them to really provide the maximum kind of service. So I guess what I'm looking at is these are, again, reflect need, but can you say something about the caseload demands on the caseworkers?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, thank you. First, I want to share a positive story that relates to your question. At the same time that this caseload has gone up, our organization has been implementing what we call the Lean Daily Management System. Some of you may be familiar with it, to become more efficient and effective in our processes. And what we have seen is our productivity levels around eligibility actually increase over this four-year period. So even with staff that are stretched very far, we went from, on average, for example, about a 9-day turnaround for someone to get their food benefits to a same-day, next-day turnaround at this very same time. And I think our agency needs to be really proud of the fact that we're working smarter with the resource we have. That being said, our staffing levels on average across the department, we actually use a workload model, not a caseload model in Oregon, because every case doesn't require the same amount of time. So we do time studies by program area to measure how much time in a particular role certain functions take. And on average, we are 33% understaffed right now to meet all of the state and federal mandates that are currently in place. What that has meant, and a future slide on this deck kind of reflects that, is that we have to continue to press our ability to be more efficient and effective as a business, but it's meant for our staff that they have less time with people, and they're focusing more on transactional work. So we've been, one of our major strategic initiatives we call modernization is really about the ability to leverage technology differently than we do today. We have very antiquated technology that supports our staff and holds them back, and we believe that technology could enable us to spend more time more effectively with people with the limited amount of staff that we have. I want to acknowledge that I think those same pressures are true for our provider partners. They too have experienced reductions and their staffing levels have become more stretched. It's not just the department. And I think that all that combination in the social service arena of people having, you know, many more people for whom they're responsible for, it does compromise. We're a people serving business. It does compromise our ability to have that impact.
Thank you.
I was wondering, excuse me.
Yes.
May I ask a question? If you could share with us, if you have any idea, what is the average benefit amount per family on your, like SNAP, TANF, and developmental disabilities? I assume the disabilities would be per child. Do you know what the average is per household? That's distributed as a benefit per month?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, not for every program, and I can definitely get back to you with that information. On the previous slide, we made a note that our average supplemental nutrition assistance payment is around $230 per household, but I think I need to dig a little deeper for you in each of these areas and make sure we're answering the question that you want to have answered.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Gomper. Were you still?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the director answered this already, but I've got a bit of a head cold and I'm not understanding quite as quickly as I'm listening. Going back to the increase for developmental disabilities, is it your sense that that we're seeing increasing incidence? Are we seeing simply improved diagnosis, or do we have more people that are requesting it?
Representative Tomei and Representative Gromberg, yes. But again, there actually has been an autism commission that has spent quite a bit of time on this and put out a report that I'd be happy to circulate to the committee, because I think it's really worth reading and it makes some significant recommendations. I think we're getting better at acknowledging and diagnosing. I think there is an increase in incidents, potentially. And I think all of the dynamics around service that Representative Gelser highlighted are there as well. So,
all right. Thank you very much.
May I continue? I appreciate the indulgence of the committee. We quickly turned around an updated version of our PowerPoint to make sure that you had all of our major programs represented in these slides. The main message of the next two slides, this shows adults, this shows youth, is really to highlight the overlap across major programs, which is important not to suggest that every population or person that we serve has the exact same needs or needs to be served in the exact same way, but it is important to us as we think about our business model and the opportunities to leverage resources and serve people by meeting their needs as opposed to simply looking at what programs they qualify for. So here you can see that more than 50% of the adults that we serve are served by more than one of our programs. And almost three quarters of the young people that we serve are served by more than one program. This, I know you're not a budget committee, but I wanted to make sure that you had some perspective on our budget and where the money goes. And if I could certainly provide more perspective on that if you were interested, but this just highlights the amount of investment that is made in different areas, that, which I've already touched on. This slide is really about the...
Yes, everything.
I'm sorry, Director, when you brought that up. So this chart we're looking at, again, we're not Ways and Means, but this is the money going out. So what's your overhead to send that money out? Do you have, is that in this slide that I'm missing?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnant, I think I mentioned this, but the administrative infrastructure in support of the department is around 5% of our budget.
That's good. Thank you.
Is that what you're asking? Thank you. So I've touched on this, but for our organization, we really are functioning in what we believe is an environment where the operational framework that has been historic for human services, and this is not unique to Oregon, this is true for human service organizations across the country, needs to be revisited, updated, and moving forward. And I want to just acknowledge that individually within programs, we have an incredibly exciting body of work going on, which I'll highlight in just a minute. But what this slide is intending to reflect is really our vision for the culture of our organization and how we work together to achieve results for people. I think that you're going to hear from us when you get a chance to listen to conversations about bills or about certain focus areas, less a focus just on a particular program, but more a focus on what are the needs of the people that we're serving, what are the resources available within our agency, within the community to meet those needs, and how are we leveraging across programs in order to achieve the best result we can for people. We really have been, because of how we're funded and so much of our funding coming from the federal government, and those funds come with expectations, rightfully so, we've been an organization that had been in the past really focused on regulation and administration, very compliance-oriented, and, you know, as we're finding right now, we really need to be pushing toward not outputs and just measuring how many people come through our door, but really, are we getting results? What is the result we're getting for those individuals, and have we achieved it? Before, we've been very focused on our policy and our program. We have really amazing staff and amazing partners who have strong allegiance oftentimes to the particular focus that they came to work for. And yet, I think we're recognizing that that it's really time for us to refocus on our customers and less on the infrastructure that we've built to date to support that service, and to think about, for example, the issue was brought up about children with developmental disabilities and child welfare. We have a very lively conversation happening right now between our child welfare program and our developmental disability program around some of the innovation that we're seeking in the child welfare program, and how can we support that same kind of innovation and service delivery expansion around the population of kids that we serve with developmental disabilities and their families, and vice versa. What are their needs, and are we meeting them in the child welfare program? That's the one program area, by the way, that has actually had a caseload reduction. We've been working very, very hard to reduce our foster care caseload in the state safely, and we have been successful at that in the last 4 years, and that's been very intentional, very deliberate on our part. But again, looking back at that first slide around service equity, we need to continually go back and look at, is that happening for all kids? And if not, why not? And what are we doing about that? We have, as I mentioned, data systems, I think over 200 of them in our department that have been independently built and conceived of, and we have a major initiative going on to ensure that clients don't have to retell their stories every time they touch another person's, they have an encounter with our system, that we keep information confidential and private, that we honor all of those things, but that we create more of an ability to communicate and support people more holistically, which is not our current technology experience and our staff staff are constantly fighting against the technology instead of having it be a tool that helps them. We really believe that our staff needs to drive the conversation about solutions, and I've given a couple examples of that today. We want to have agendas that are more proactive and anticipatory. Our business is often designed around meeting people at their time of crisis, and what we all know really well is that our resources are used more effectively when we can get out ahead of issues, and often it's much more effective for that person. It has a greater impact, and it happens to also cost taxpayers less. And finally, we don't do this business on our own. We really depend on collaboration, community partnership across service sectors, and we understand that, and I think we're also working hard to make sure that in seniors, for example, that as health systems transformation is going on, that we're making sure that our senior service system is thinking about and partnering with and identifying shared accountability for results. And we could really say that for every population around health systems transformation. So I mentioned that this would be high level and try to be fast. I wasn't quite as fast as I would have liked. You also have the handout on some of the forward-looking initiatives, but I don't want to take more time than the chair has graciously given me. So I just would stop and ask, would you like me to spend any time on those, or do you need to move forward on the agenda? Okay.
Go ahead. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned one of the good news stories, that there are fewer kids in child welfare foster care, which I know is in large part due to your great work on making our child welfare system more child-friendly and child-focused and family-focused. Is that, and there's two sections of foster care, so the SPD foster care and the child welfare. Has the caseload declined in both areas, or can you find out for us if that decline is in both foster care programs?
Representative, I'd like to ask you not to use acronyms.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The child welfare foster care, and then the other one, the senior and people with disabilities child foster care, which is that voluntary placement where there has been no abuse or neglect.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, I'll get you that information.
Thank you.
So just really quickly, if I may, and I do appreciate the additional time, I've talked about some of this, but I'll just hit the highlights. Starting with the modernization of human service delivery, I just want to mention that this is not just, to begin with, our aging and people with disabilities and self-sufficiency programs primarily. It is also a partnership with the health authority around the exchange and the Medicaid program. For those of you who don't know, the Department of Human Services enrolls about 80% of the clients in the Oregon Health Plan. So even though there's an Oregon Health Authority that administers the health benefits for those clients and is responsible for policy and programming around the Oregon Health Plan, our organization provides the enrollment for people with that idea that there's no wrong door, that people, remember the bubble slides, that's what I call them, where many people are qualifying for multiple programs at once. We want people to only have to come in one time, give us information, and be able to qualify for the services that they qualify for. So we do determine eligibility, as I said, for about 80% of the health plan clients. We have a major effort going on to really redesign and think differently about our service delivery model, which for us means things like getting out of our offices and being more available to clients in other places, in schools and community partner organizations. It's also meant bringing community partner organizations into our offices. Last session, you all were instrumental in helping us to co-locate domestic violence advocates in our offices, which has had a very significant impact on our ability to better support survivors of domestic violence to stay together with their kids. So really it's about the technology, but it's also about service delivery transformation and moving our system and our service delivery model into the 21st century. So I expect that we'll be talking more about that. It has been mentioned that we've had a very concentrated focus on safe and equitable foster care reduction. We have, over the last 5 years, safely reduced foster care by almost 18% in the state. And that has happened in partnership with a lot of community partners as well as the judicial branch. And we've had a lot of consultation also from the national partner in Casey Family Programs. We have the next wave of that conversation coming before you this legislative session. around implementation of a bill that you all passed last session, fully implementing it statewide. It's called the Strengthening, Reunifying, and Preserving Families Bill, and also really transforming the front end of our service delivery model in child welfare to be more about keeping families together in partnership with communities so that we can support child safety in a different way than we do today. That is also not just about child welfare, I should mention, but we have been having the crossover conversation with the developmental disability side of our work, as well as with self-sufficiency, which is responsible for family stability services in many instances. We have important conversations happening around seniors and adults with disabilities and the long-term care services that we provide for them, anticipating in the future and the caseload growth that we imagine is possible as the baby boom generation is aging. And as those who are aging are living longer, we're looking ahead and thinking about how do we maintain our national status. We are nationally recognized in Oregon for our long-term care system. People have worked really hard the last three decades to create a system that supports most seniors and people with disabilities in their own homes. Only about 17% of seniors and people with disabilities who use our long-term care Medicaid services depend on nursing facility care for those services. That's one of the smallest percentages in the country, and it's something we're really proud of and we want to be able to maintain. So that's the 3.0 piece. Also mentioned there, of course, is our partnership with the health authority around health systems transformation. Representative Gilliam and Representative Gelser have both been leaders around the issue for us of improving our adult protective services for people with disabilities, people with developmental disabilities, and seniors. And we have a really aggressive agenda happening to improve our practice in that area, to improve our partnerships with law enforcement in that area, and to improve our ability to prevent, wherever possible, abuse and to respond adequately and effectively when abuse happens. And so we're excited to keep that conversation going with this committee. And finally, employment. Employment is one of those crossover issues. We aren't the employment department, but employment is a significant issue for so many, if not almost all of our clients. We, as I mentioned earlier, it's one of our primary outcomes for people with developmental disabilities, for people with disabilities, for families, parents with children. We really believe that when people can work and support themselves, they're more likely to be safe, stable, and healthy, all the things that are the mission of the department. And so we have a cross-programmatic initiative to leverage our employment efforts. We're also working with community colleges, workforce development, the employment department. So we're really excited about not just focusing on programs and program improvements, but really focusing on the results that we're trying to get for people and challenging all of our programs within the agency to be able to move toward those goals together. So that's the high-level summary of that sheet of paper.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Erin. So any questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not a question, but if you permit me just a couple of quick comments about this presentation. The first is, of course, to thank you again for having our director in, because at the beginning part of the committee, I think it's extremely helpful to have her here. And I'm not going to disagree with what you sort of warned us about, and I usually do disagree with you, but I'm not going to disagree with what you said at the end of the last committee, which is, for those of you who are new to the committee, you do need to be prepared for some tough stories. But here's the good news, and I want to say this particularly for we'll call them the newbies, but by their questions and their background, you certainly have a great grasp of a lot of these issues, so I'm not calling you out on that. But for the old-timers, this has been a great experience here, and part of it is because of the leadership at the department. I've learned a lot from Representative Gelser and certainly from Madam Chair. And by the way, Representative Kenny Geyer, you got away with some acronyms earlier.
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah.
Thank you for pointing
out.
Very
fortunate. But my point is this. We're listening to the head of the largest department, as she said, in the state. And the numbers are always, to me, staggering. And they're growing. And we know they're growing because of the economy and because there are so many vulnerable people. But for me, she's just one of the best we have in state government. can you imagine her job? And I think she does it very well, and she's backed up by very good people, and they've probably all already come to visit you in your offices. And they're very available, and they're very helpful. The last thing I would say is the reason I feel so strongly about this is because of our experience with the elder abuse bill. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I hope you'll all stay tuned to that, because I think we're probably going to have another, probably not as extensive, but we're going to have round two of that. But that could have been a very divisive, ugly, awful thing. And thanks to Madam Chair bringing it to everyone's attention and the department's response of taking responsibility, of immediately putting a task force together that blended to the task force that we formed, we were able to pass a bill because people weren't pointing fingers. We were trying to figure out what some of the problems were. There's a lot to be proud of, particularly in just that area of elder abuse, but they were being criticized. Our director took that as constructive criticism, and we made, I think, something very good out of something that could have potentially been very bad. So I just want to make sure that you know who you have in front of you, a very capable professional and thorough person in charge of this department. There's a lot to learn about it, and there's a lot of things I'm critical about, but I think you'll find it's an amazing thing that they do for vulnerable citizens. And I'm just, again, pleased that you would have her in. I appreciate very much your overview. I appreciate a lot of things about you, and one of them is your desire and ability to reach out to partners in the faith community, in our nonprofit community, a task that we've taken on to help. Because the whole point is, and I think your mission in your heart that you've shared is, we want to help as many people as efficiently and effectively as we can. And so it's just an extraordinary thing, and I just wanted to offer that for the newbies. This is a really good person that we have in front of us, and if she ever runs for governor, it'll be like, if she wins, it'll be like taking a vacation. That's a really easy job compared to what she does. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Aaron, I've never seen you blush like this. Thank you, Representative Gilliam. That was really lovely. Thank you so much.
Yes, Representative. I was wondering if, since it is one of the bright, shining parts of our state policy, if you could discuss or help bring numbers to us about the savings that Oregon is realizing by being a leader in keeping their seniors in their homes instead of being institutionalized, and that would really be helpful. To put a face on the numbers there. So.
That would be great, and maybe we could have a hearing on that. It needn't be a long, long hearing, but it would be great for us to hear how that has happened and how it helps. That's a great idea. Thank you. Any other? In fact, what I'd like to do is invite the committee. If there are any other parts of Department of Human Services that you would like more information on, we can certainly bring Aaron back and the people who work with her. I know we're going to be having some hearings about elder abuse and other abuse, and we'll also be having hearings about foster care. Any other areas in which you're particularly interested, anyone?
EADC. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Employment-related daycare.
Good. Yes, I'd like that, too. Good. Anything else? And, you know, I'm not sure if this would be in the Health Committee or in our committee, but I just wrote myself a note that I'd be really interested in hearing about the autism report. I know that Chair Greenick has a special interest in that, so maybe that will be happening in the Health Committee, but if it doesn't, I would certainly like to have it in here. Maybe we could have it in both chambers or both hearings, committees.
Yes. On the autism thing, I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is many of the individuals receiving developmental disability services, most of the individuals receiving developmental disability services don't have autism. And I think one of the missing links that the Autism Commission was talking about, many people that experience autism are not eligible for developmental disability services because of the way that testing is done for that eligibility. So if we do a hearing on autism, I think that would be one of the interesting things to look at, is who comes together to support those individuals with autism, and then what is the difference between people with autism and people that experience intellectual and developmental disabilities, right? People in those communities, it's an
and
important
would you
question
work with
today.
Our staff, Regina, to help her set that up? That would be terrific. Thank you. questions or concerns? Thanks again, Erin. That was terrific. Thank you so much. Okay, I will close the informational hearing on human services, and now we'll have an overview of housing. And we have Margaret Van Vliet. Thank you, Margaret. Gina Woolley, Tom Clancy Burns. We have two more people. Should we just start with three?
Sure.
Okay. Welcome.
I have the unenviable position of following Erin Kelly Seal. No, I don't have any idea. Ben is here. He might be.
There we go.
The arrow keys? Okay. All right. Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm really thrilled to be here today because I'm here largely because you have added housing to your purview. And I think that is a terrific thing for lots and lots of reasons. So it gives me really a lot of pleasure to be in front of you and share some of what's going on in the housing world generally and in our agency specifically. I'm going to give you a little bit of a backgrounder on some transition work that's happening at the agency, and then a very quick overview of the kind of the scope of work that our agency takes on, and know that we'll probably want to have more conversations throughout the session. I'm a relatively new agency director. I arrived a little over a year ago at the invitation of Governor Kitzhaber to really strengthen the housing delivery system so that it could be more aligned with the other big efforts happening in state government around health and education and public safety and the rest. And I quickly had support from the governor to make some pretty major organizational changes. And I'm working really hard with our partners and our employees to increase our effectiveness and be more responsive to community needs. I've spent this past several months doing that work in depth, and really am at a place where I believe even more significant changes are needed. And I say that because I am driven, frankly, to see that more resources are delivered more effectively to low-income Oregonians. I see a need for much more alignment and really a holistic look at how the housing and community services investments that we make as a state really support the other agendas that we need to work on as a state agency. So that's sort of the background of why I'm here. I want to give you a little bit of context about our role. We are, technically speaking, a housing finance agency as chartered, and we have 49 peer agencies around the country that look a lot like us in many ways. When we started, it was because the federal government gave states the ability to issue tax-exempt debt to finance mortgages, single-family mortgages for first-time home buyers, and then eventually multifamily affordable rental housing. And over time, the federal government also began to send states other tools, low-income housing tax credits, grants from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and other things. A little over 20 years ago, a suite of programs that was known as community services programs or safety net programs were added to the agency. And the reasoning at the time had to do with this idea that maybe if we had one agency that could look at the continuum of housing needs from homelessness all the way through home ownership, that we could get better policy alignment. And I think there were some good wins out of that. But what we found today is that they're pretty distinct and different service delivery mechanisms. On the one hand, we act like a bank, and we finance development, and we do real estate stuff. And on the other hand, we act like a grants administrator. We send money to local nonprofits for them to do their work. And those things, while in some ways are aligned, we haven't really gotten the alignment and the continuum of housing delivery systems that I think folks hoped to, you know, some 20 years ago. The other thing that is important to know about the agency is that we really very much rely on partners for service delivery. We don't do direct service. We don't own any real estate. We're nobody's landlord. We are a pass-through. So we're a bank on the one hand, again, and we rely on local nonprofits to do work on our behalf on the other hand. So we don't do, there's very little that we do that's direct client service. And over the last several years in particular, there have been major shifts in how housing finance works in this country and certainly in this state. And so I think that gives us both a moment of, you know, reflection on what our financial underpinnings are, but also a real unique opportunity to think about our role differently. And that's the charge that we're taking up now. And I should say here that part of the underpinning in the overview is that as the Housing Finance Agency and this ability to issue tax-exempt debt, over time we'd accumulated very large bond indentures that provided unrestricted, if you will, cash to the agency. And we were able to use that to supplement programs and even our operations. And that source of cash, for a variety of reasons, is really drying up, if you will. And so we can talk more about that through the session and later on, and certainly you're not a budget committee, as Aaron pointed out, but I'm happy to share those kinds of financial analyses. But it brings a moment of sort of fiscal crisis, if you will, but also an opportunity to do some things really differently and maybe even transformative. So the moment that the governor's asked us to take up is really to think about realigning the way we deliver services with our partners at the local level, so that there's more synergy and alignment with the 10-year plan and the work of other agencies, those other big systems, education, health, public safety, and the others, and really sharpen our focus on being good stewards of limited funds and driving as much money to help low-income people as we possibly can. And so you see here an excerpt from what the governor's budget recommends, which is, as and some of you are aware of this, the governor's budget actually recommends 1 year of funding for the biennium for my agency while we take up a planning effort to think differently about a service delivery model. So I'm going to talk with you a little bit about how we're starting that effort, and again, know that we'll come back.
And that's a very important statement, and I hope that we all are digesting mm-hmm. what that means. It's just being funded for 1 year, mm-hmm. and then whatever's going to be happening in the future, if I'm correct here, Margaret, is there will be a whole new program. Is that
That's correct, Chair Tomei. I think what we want to do is put forth our best thinking about what a different service delivery model would look like, and then have that be sort of vetted and understood and debated and discussed, and assuming there's consensus and approval, ultimately, that we would move to implement likely at the beginning of the 15-17 biennium. So let me come back to that and just give you a quick view of the kinds of programs that we're talking about here. We've grouped them in this way, frankly, because this is how our budget has them organized, and there's some logic to it, but it's not magic, and it's one of the things we're going to start looking at. But we see our programs at a high level across these areas: a multifamily safety net, energy and weatherization, single family finance, and then some foreclosure mitigation work. There's overlap and crossover within those areas. again, recognizing you're not a budget committee, but just broad brush, here are, on the multifamily side, a quick view of what our primary funding sources are and the way in which we get that money out the door. We fund multifamily development, acquisition and rehab, and preservation. We serve as a bank along with, the private sector in investing in these properties. I've given you just a quick view of some basic metrics over the last several years as well. I'm going to go through these very quickly. What we call safety net services are delivered largely by our community action program partners across the state. We get a variety of federal funds and some state general fund. These are the services that you would think of as emergency food assistance, homeless assistance and interventions, and then sort of rental assistance. I think we have a question.
Madam Chair.
I was wondering if the food boxes distributed refers to or is in conjunction with the Oregon Food Bank. Or separate.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, yes, that is part with that is the food bank network that runs through our agency and our partner agencies. Yes. Okay. Much of this is also delivered through our community action partners. It's energy and weatherization. It's mostly, but not exclusively, federal funds. There are state funds as well. And this is where low-income people have access to utility bill payment assistance, energy conservation services, and weatherization kinds of help. And again, you can see some basic metrics there over time. On the single family side, and again, this goes back to this was our bread and butter for many years, the single family bond program. It has been supplemented in recent years with federal funds and some of the document recording fee that the legislature passed a couple of sessions ago. Our delivery partners are diverse, but it includes community action agencies, mortgage originators, and regional housing centers, which are nonprofits, and in many cases, banks are involved in those as well. So we do have a single-family home ownership loan program that is originated by banks out in the community and mortgage brokers, but our regional housing centers also do a variety of services to get people ready for home ownership, and then there is funds for down payment assistance. This part of our business has dropped off dramatically in the last several years.
So, Margaret, talk some about that, the change from 2007 to 2012.
So that is largely a function of for most of our history, this product, the single family loan product, we could provide an interest rate advantage because we had this tax exempt debt, and we could offer a below market interest rate loan to first time home buyers who fit an income profile. And there was enough of an advantage that for people who fit that profile, they'd come to us, and that was the public policy benefit, as we were encouraged first-time home ownership. With interest rates the way they've been for several years, we don't have the rate advantage anymore.
Right. Good. Thank you.
And then the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative, or OHSI, this is the program some of you are familiar with. It is the federal U.S. Treasury program known as Hardest Hit. It's actually funded with federal TARP dollars. This came to us because we were one of the hardest hit states in the country a few years ago. And we are now working well with our nonprofit partners to get this money out the door. And you can see a few of the metrics there. This program is limited in duration. It must be all done by 2017. We think we'll be done probably in 2015.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
We want to compliment some of the better state employees. I'd have to compliment the director here because she was able to manipulate, that's a terrible word. She was able to remanage some funds because while we were limited, Central Oregon was hard hit by the housing thing, and she was able to find a way that we could keep the money in Central Oregon, not by county, and I appreciate her work and leadership in that.
Thank you. And then just as a quick overview of how our budget is constructed, we get very little general fund, and so this is a look at kind of what our major funding sources are. This other fund's limited and non-limited. That's the bond indenture work. That's the bond debt service, and that sort of flows through the budget, so it's a very large budget if you include all of that, but that's mostly bond debt service. The bottom half of that page just shows where state general fund goes that comes through my agency.
Madam Chair.
Yes, that's Sue Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why does CASA go through your program? Court-appointed special advocates.
Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, the CASA, the Court-Appointed Special Advocates, was placed in our agency last session. They needed a home for it after the Commission on Children and Families was disbanded, and its parts sort of put in other places. We actually also run the Oregon Volunteers Program. That runs through our budget. And so since it is at its core a volunteer program, I think the thinking was that would be a good home for it. At the same time, I think there is lots of conversation about what's a good long-term fit for CASA and also the volunteer program in general. So we're sort of being the fiscal stewards. It's probably not a long-term fit. We love them. I don't mean to imply otherwise. Just as we wrap up here a little bit, I would say we know there's several housing-related bills moving through the session. We're not out in front on any of them. My agency has its hands full with taking on this transition. We'll be supportive. And these bills that are mentioned here all do, in their current form, mention our agency, that some new responsibility or money might come to my agency. And what we're saying about that, what I want to share with you is, even if we're disbanded or, you know, realigned or restructured in some way, we know we'll have some housing finance functions in the state of Oregon, and so the question will become, how do you group those and administer them into the future in responsible ways with good policy intent? So this is just a flag to note that we know those are coming through. And so before I wrap up, just a word about where I see the agency going over the course of the next several months. We are working on standing up a pretty robust planning process. We want to have a lot of transparency and engagement. Our customers rely on our programs and the funding that we send to them. Our partners and advocates care a lot about what happens to these programs. And so we know that there's a lot of stakeholders who have a real interest in what happens, and that we want to do this in a way that we get their best thinking. Again, we don't do direct service. It's our partners who do direct service. So we'll only benefit and make better decisions if we rely on their expertise. We'll be as transparent as we possibly can, and we'll work very hard to keep the trains running, right? We'll work really hard to make sure that there's not an interruption in the ongoing business of the agency while we have a planning process. So we're just at the beginning stages, and we'll look forward to talking further with the committee through the session.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Any questions? All right. Thank you. That's a lot to get our hands around.
Yes,
so
it is.
Thank you very much. So now we have Jean Woolley, Tom Clancy Burns, Allison McIntosh, and Andy Wolf. Is there helping to bring you all up together, or do you want to come in twos? How would you like to do this? And don't everybody speak at once. Pardon? Oh, that's just fine. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Gina Woolley, and I am the chair of the State Housing Council. The State Housing Council is a policy advisory council to the Oregon Housing and Community Services, and we also have responsibility for approving several of the gap financing streams of gap funding that go into our development deals. Margaret's provided you with a great overview of how the housing, the Oregon Housing and Community Services is structured, what we do generally, and what resources support the work that we do. I'd like to just, you know, give you an idea of some of the trends that are affecting the environment that we're doing business in. Some of them Margaret's already alluded to, but low-income housing tax credits, I'll be careful not to use acronyms, but low-income housing tax credits, the investors are becoming more selective, and there seems to be a trend towards increasing yields on the investments, which in turn means that it's harder to put deals together because the amount, the pricing that the investors are paying for the tax credits is beginning to be reduced, which means you get less money for those tax credits, which means deals are become harder to put together. And so it's going to, you know, looking forward, if this trend takes hold and continues, it's going to be more difficult.
I'm going to stop you for a moment.
Yes.
I really don't know anything about the State Housing Council. So are you funded by general funds? How are you funded? And are you a state agency?
We're a volunteer advisory board. We don't have any funding that's specific to the State Housing Council.
So who do you advise?
We advise Margaret and the department.
I'm still somewhat confused, and I'm sorry to express my ignorance
Margaret,
here.
Can you help me, please?
Can I show you?
I would love to.
Yes.
Again, Margaret Van Vliet. So the Housing Council is the advisory body that's explicitly appointed by the governor to advise the department on expenditures of certain of our streams of funding. Some of you have heard me say that I actually have seven statutorily named advisory bodies. One, and probably the primary one, is the State Housing Council, and they are appointed by the governor, and the main things they do are approve, they have a fiduciary responsibility to approve expenditures of certain streams of money, basically the loans and grants for single-family and multifamily development. So they see transactions coming through and have an approval process.
So this body, the State Housing Council, is appointed by the governor to advise your agency.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is
correct.
Thank
you.
Yeah. We have no budget, or the department staffs us, so we don't. We're not an entity, you know, that has its own budget and expenditures and all of that. We come to Salem once a month or to a State Housing Council meeting to transact business and to advise on where things are going, how things are developing, the transformation to add input. The council is made up of essentially the CAP. We have representatives. We're kind of a broad-based body. There's seven members on the State Housing Council, and we there's representation from the community action agencies, for-profit and nonprofit development community, housing authorities, local housing authorities.
One local government.
Local government elected official. And so the strategic partners that actually work with us to make things happen at the local level in communities around the state, we have representation from those strategic partners on the State Housing Council. So it's a very diverse group at this point that pretty much hits most of the strategic partnership groups that we work with at the local level to do development and to deliver community services to local communities.
So this is one of the seven advisory bodies that advise you. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so are we going to hear from the other six?
I don't believe that that's been arranged today, no. There is cross, some of the people you hear from today are representative of those groups, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so If you excuse me, I mean, I feel like I should be more on top of this, but I'm obviously not. So the other people who advise you, they all advise you, is that right? They all advise your agency, is that correct?
Yeah, Chair Tomei, would you like me to rattle them off for you so that you...
Sure.
Yes, so we do have the Community Action Directors of Oregon. We have the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness. We have the Hunger Relief Task Force. We have the Ending Homelessness Advisory Committee. The Farm Worker Housing Facilitation Team, and the Advisory Committee on Energy. Now, so again, the one of those bodies, so they're all named in statute as advising on particular streams of money or parts of the housing problem. The Housing Council, I would say, has a particular role because they're appointed by the governor.
And the others are not?
And the others are not.
Okay. And why does he do that? Why does he choose to appoint this group?
Because it's in statute. I don't have a good answer to that, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I don't actually know the answer to that.
I think it was the way that it was set up originally.
Okay.
When the department
do it
was formed.
It's always been done
fiduciary
this way.
Oversight is how I would characterize it.
Okay.
And I don't know that whether this is correct or not, but it may have been that it was the first advisory committee, and some of these other advisory committees have been added over time as the state took sort of a policy position on trying to affect those particular areas of activity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay, thank you, Margaret. Thank you, Gina.
No, you don't have to. I may need your help again. You never know. So I was starting to talk about the trends, and I talked a little bit about the changing marketplace for low-income housing tax credits. I think, obviously, Margaret spoke a little bit about the turmoil in the financial markets has significantly changed how we're doing business in certain program areas, specifically the single, the home ownership single family bond program. Local governments have become stressed to the breaking point by loss of revenue streams and the housing crisis, which has reduced revenues at the local level. And these, the investments that we make in local communities require multiple pots of money to get a deal done. And as local communities become more stressed and do not have resources to add value or to fill gaps in those deals, it makes those deals more difficult to do. So we lose the ability to leverage our resources with local resources in communities that are struggling revenue-wise themselves. There's also, at this point in time, a balloon of expiring 15-year federally subsidized affordable housing projects. These are HUD contracts that were put in place a number of years back, and we need to be able to refinance these and preserve as many of these projects so that they don't revert to the private marketplace, so that we can preserve, this is what the preservation issue is all about, those units, because it's much more cost effective, generally speaking, to preserve those subsidized units that already have the federal subsidy than to create new ones with the diminishing resources that we have to invest in affordable housing production. There's also a trend towards cutting costs, and I mean this is because of local government, state government, federal governments all have reduced resources of dissembling coordinated programs, expertise, and anti-poverty revenue streams.
And this poses a potential threat to the capacity of local community action agencies and other partners to service the growing need in communities across Oregon if we aren't careful in how we rethink the delivery system. And what I mean here is that we need to make sure that the reorganization of the administrative functions of these programs, because that's what OHCS does, is it administers the administration of these programs on behalf of our community partners. If we simply look to consolidate and to cut cost at the state level, the potential to create a burden to push those costs, we may simply be transferring cost down to those local, to our service providers, who then have to, you know, instead of going one place to get five different pieces of money to do a deal, they may have to go five places. They may have five audits they have to do every year for compliance, for, you know, in relationship to the funding stream. So we need to be smart and thoughtful about how we streamline the system so that we truly are reducing cost and making things more efficient, but we aren't simply transferring cost.
Yes.
May I ask a question? Because I'm just not familiar with this being new on the committee, the 15 HUD contracts, is that what you said?
No, they're generally 15-year contracts,
okay.
Yes.
The 15-year HUD contracts were regarding renting?
They're contracts
owning
to develop affordable housing, and so you may have a private individual or a nonprofit that goes to HUD to secure financing to purchase and or develop an affordable housing, and it comes with subsidies for the units. So the housing is already subsidized because of the HUD.
Is it paid for then, or are you, you know, when these contracts expire, is this going to fall under the state of Oregon then to make up?
No, they'll go away unless we actually are able to recapture those, because they still have debt on them.
Okay,
generally.
That's what I'm asking. Is there still debt, and how much debt is left? If it's a 15-year,
depends on how the deal is structured. You know, these in the front end, how much it costs. So it varies. Is the best.
Could you get us a number on the amount of these contracts that are left and what the balance is?
Barbara, do you have?
We'll
yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. I'm feeling at a loss here. I'm feeling like I'm still trying to get my brain around this. That's okay. You're telling us important information, but you're saying you're new to this committee. I'm new to this whole issue.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm really wanting to understand sort of the basic issue.
Right.
And so you're telling us specific problems and
I'm talking about the climate that we're doing business in.
And
yes.
Look us on us as fourth graders. We're really, we don't... Yes.
Chair, it might help if we could... The committee could understand how tax credits work, particularly with regard to housing. I think that might be a useful discussion to have.
It would be, and maybe we can do that another day. I think today what I'd really like to understand, and maybe that's what we can ask of Gina and Tom, Allison and Andy, and maybe, Margaret, we need you to come back in too.
Probably.
Is sort of understand this whole agency and the issues. And I understand we've got some problems, and that's up to us to start dealing with those and understand those. But first of all, thank you. I sort of want to understand the underlying issues and problems.
Chair Tomei, if I think I fully appreciate sort of just the blowback with getting all this information kind of dumped on you. All of us, even us who've been volunteers when we were appointed to the council, it may take us a year to really understand even how the agency works. Oregon Housing and Community Services is very complex. We manage multiple streams of resources that are going down to local partners, and we have a number of complicated programs. Every one of them is unique. It has its own requirements. So, I think that given that this is a new arena for the committee, that it would make a lot of sense to try to do a work session just around understanding how each of these funding streams works. I'm not in a position to provide you with that information. I don't even think Margaret is today, but I think that's probably going to be important to really begin to understand the issues.
I think you're giving us information that's important, but it's hard to put it in any kind of context.
I fully understand that.
Yeah. So is that something that the speakers that we've invited up to come here, is that something you can help us do? I know you have prepared testimony. I'm not sure that's really going to benefit us if we don't know where to put that information. Is that something you can come up and do together? I mean, can we get the four of you up together to sort of educate us about this? This is totally new to this committee. What do you think, Margaret? I know you know.
Okay.
And John, I know you're here too. So you want to come join us?
Yeah.
And we're just going to have a panel discussion here. Does that work?
Yeah, and I was thinking about they've got something they could draw with over there. Isn't there?
That's right. That would be good.
Yeah, right. And the whiteboard.
So
I love
yes,
it.
They mm-hmm. could say this is the overarching thing, and then go down like that.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think one of the best signs of an agency and people are when people are extraordinarily flexible like this to do something new.
I just like writing on a board.
Yes.
That's exciting.
Yes. Yes.
Great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. The reason that I'm up here is just to provide a quick historical context, which I think may be helpful for the committee.
Okay.
I often joke with people that I go back to the beginning of time because I've been around for decades, but I was the director of Clackamas County Social Services, as you know, Madam Chair, for many years. And during when Barbara Roberts was elected in 1990, I was part of her transition team. And a discussion we had on the transition team at that time was that we had a standalone housing agency that was not doing very well, and the State Community Services Program inside of the Department of Human Services that didn't seem to fit in very well. And those of us on the transition team said, we have an opportunity to look at creation of an organization that brings together the synergy of housing, community services, but with an anti-poverty focus, which is some of what's been kind of missing in the presentation today. The Community Action Agency programs, which were the local delivery system for state community services, go back to the war and poverty days. They were created in 1964, and community action agencies serve all around the state to this day. So the issue, I think, when you circle back to this to think about what kind of recommendations may ultimately be made about these programs, I think the history helps in thinking about what was the intent. Now, the missions were supposed to be co-equal, even though many more resources are on the housing side, because if we think about what happens with individuals and families that are struggling with a number of needs at the local level, they may have all sorts of issues relating to food, housing, transportation, and so forth, but also housing.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of these things working together in synergy was really the original intent
mm-hmm.
of the organization. So I just wanted to put that on the record, and I hope that's helpful.
That's very helpful. Thank you. We only have, 20 minutes, 22 minutes? So can you sort of work as a panel to sort of educate us fourth graders here about what it is, what the issue is, what the problems are? And I promise, I know you've got materials ready, and we'll have you back again when we understand a little bit more about what these issues are. We'll have you back again, and you can tell us your particular questions and problems, and we'll try to work on those. And also, I'd like this committee to be thinking of someone who might have an interest in this issue, who would be willing to work with some of these folks on, since the governor is only funding this agency for 1 year, am I correct? So there need to be some very drastic changes within this next year. So who, if there's any legislator here who would be willing to work with some of these folks that can bring something back to this committee, and I know a lot of it goes to Ways and Means, but Ways and Means is going to be depending on us to make recommendations. Joe, do I see you interested in this?
I'll bring something back. I don't know exactly what, but yeah.
Would you be willing to work with some of these folks?
Sure.
Wonderful. Thank you. Anybody else? Terrific. Thank you so much. We'll talk more about that later. Great. Margaret, write that name down. Okay. All right. Great. So talk to us for 20 minutes. I don't want to hear your prepared testimony. I want to hear about what it is we should know. What's the foundation of what we should know?
Absolutely. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Policy and Communications Director for Neighborhood Partnerships. I'm actually here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify, and I will do my best to try to paint a little bit of a picture of what we think the needs are and how we think about housing, to try to give you a little bit of background, and feel free to interrupt with questions. So first, just let me say the Housing Alliance is so very excited that there's now a committee that includes a focus on housing, and we are looking forward to working with you during the coming session. So we are a coalition of nearly 60 organizations across the state, all interested in increasing the supply of safe, stable, and affordable housing. We have a diverse membership, which includes nonprofit housing providers, service providers, cities, counties, and others. So please think of us as a resource. We have many members that are really experts in a lot of these things that you'll be grappling with and are happy to help you think about these issues. Fundamentally, the Housing Alliance believes that everyone needs a safe, stable place to call home, and that home is really the foundation of opportunity for all Oregonians. So just to touch briefly on the need, the packet that was sent around actually has, we have need sheets that we've developed for each of the 36 counties that talk about incomes versus rent in all of our communities across the state, and I've given you a sample of some today. We know that every month in Oregon, too many families are forced to choose between paying the rent and putting food on the table or buying medicine. Last year alone, 20,000 school children experienced homelessness at some point during the school year. And seniors and people with disabilities often have a really difficult time affording rent on a fixed income. So we've included, as I said, some information about those housing needs in each county. So at the Housing Alliance, we often talk about housing needs as a continuum. On one end of the continuum, you may have people that have been experiencing homelessness and need some supportive services or a permanent rent subsidy to really exit homelessness. Or you may have families that need just a little bit of assistance to get back on their feet and either prevent or end their homelessness. You may have folks all across the state who just need a little bit of, they may need affordable housing. They're not able to access market rate housing with their income as it exists. And then you may have some other families that really need just a little bit of help to get into homeownership for the first time. So the Housing Alliance is, while we know that there are many housing needs in our communities, we also really believe that we know how to solve these problems. We know how to prevent and end homelessness. We know how to build safe, stable, and affordable housing. And we know how to help people access homeownership. So we have a variety of proposals that we're talking about this session. I would be happy to talk about those, but I'm not sure that it will be very useful to you all. But we really do see that the proposals that we put forth try to address all aspects of the continuum of housing need in our state. So I will just maybe end there and let other folks, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much.
Hello, Chair Tomei, committee members. My name is Andy Wilch. I'm the administrator of the Salem Housing Authority. It's WILCH for the record. I also today am representing the Oregon Housing Authorities Association. 22 housing authorities across the state come together in association to jointly share information, share best practices, and bring our collective passion and jurisdictions with us. Those 22 housing authorities are representative of all areas of the state. As an agency, housing authorities serve 34,000 households every year, and that vacillates to some degree, but that's our best number right now. 15,000 individuals with disabilities, 6,000 seniors, 36,000 children. For frame of reference, in the city of Salem, where I work, we serve 9,000 individuals every day, which is 3,500 households. 47% of all the people we serve are children 18 and under.
Andy, tell us how you work in the Oregon housing community. I mean, we need something. I need both of you to come here and write something on this board. So we've got the Oregon Housing and Community Services, and then where do you fit in this matrix?
Chair Tomei, let me. Housing authorities are chartered under federal law, enabled through state law. We're a separate public corporation. Only housing authorities can only be formed through a municipality, a city or a county, resolving that there's a need for affordable housing.
So I understand that, Andy, but I still want to know where you are in this matrix under the Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Housing authorities working with Oregon Housing and Community Services, they fund. Housing authorities will apply to Oregon Housing for funds to build projects, preserve housing. We're a borrower.
You borrow money from...
We apply to Oregon Housing for funds. We partner with Oregon Housing on a whole series of policy initiatives. All of the initiatives that Margaret mentioned are initiatives that housing authorities are involved with. Everybody at this table is a part of a larger consortium focusing on housing, poverty, services, and how do we help those individuals in our communities that have the fewest choices and the greatest needs.
Okay. And where is it that you feel it in this matrix?
Members of the community, Chair Tomei. As the Housing Alliance, we function more as an advocacy coalition, so we don't, a lot of our members work with and receive funding from Oregon Housing and Community Services, but the Housing Alliance itself is kind of a separate advocacy organization.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Because your other affiliation here is listed as Neighborhood Partnerships. Is that formerly Neighborhood Partnership Fund?
Yes.
And so that's the organization hat that you wear when you are a part of this alliance?
Yes. Chair Tomei.
And is that the group that oversees all the community development corporations? Is that its function? No.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kinnegeyer, Neighborhood Partnership Fund was founded in 1990 as a way to funnel national money through to community development corporations. That part of our mission has since ended. Okay. So now I work for Neighborhood Partnerships and we convene the Housing Alliance. Okay. We also wear a lot of other hats to help create opportunity for low-income Oregonians. We work with Housing and Community Services on a project to kind of track affordable housing properties, but that's our only kind of direct relationship with them.
I think what we're looking for is someone to walk up there and to draw a line across the top and say, this is where we start. Are you all under DHS?
No.
Are you under federal? I mean, we're confused enough that we do not know where is the starting point. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yes, thank you. So I'm hearing what your programs do, but I don't know how it all fits in this matrix. And who is this gentleman who was writing?
Chair.
An artist. Peter Dean Lee with Office of Oregon Executive Director, Sherwood, Oregon.
Thank you.
I'll stay quiet and just write something.
Great.
For you.
Chair, I can at least describe our part, and I think it will be somewhat helpful. So I'm Tom Clancy Burns from Community Action Partnership, and so there's 17 community action agencies around the state. We're independent from OHCS or any other governmental pieces, and you'll have a handout that shows the different types of grants we receive and those kind of things. One of our activities is we do give advice to the department based on our board, our community action board, based on some of the programs, and I would characterize it like Mr. Mullen said, it's our anti-poverty programs that we're giving advice to. If you look at the amount of funding we get from Oregon Housing Community Services, some of the bigger groups, 20 to 30%, others, the smaller groups, maybe upwards of 70%. So the community action agencies, there's 14 of them that are nonprofits. They act on their own in the sense, and then there's three publics. So that happens to be Clackamas, Multnomah, and Lane County, so they're county government. I think the real unique feature is they have a tripartite board, and that tripartite board is their governing structure, is one-third of the clients that are receiving services, one-third of the folks that are providing the services, and then they round out the rest in their community. So if you go to any, if you look at the map, colors represent the different organizations. If you flip it over, you will see that this is the matrix of services. So you'll see there's a lot of housing, but there's a lot of other things we're doing as well. And not any one community action agency looks the same, but they do have a lot of similarities. And then if you flipped again to the next page, this shows the difference in the organizational makeup. Some are really small, the more rural you get, obviously. Others are quite big. The number of grants are all over the map. So in the sense of just trying to answer your question, I think we, if you had a circle of OHCS, the CAPS would be one of those, what's the geometry term?
Yeah.
Concentric, thank you. And there'd be parts of things we all do together. And then there's stuff that we don't do at all. We'll do it with the HUD group or the housing groups or the CDCs. I don't know if that's helpful, but and I had more prepared testimony, but I can, I'll stop.
We'll have you back again.
Yes, Chair Tomei, it might be another way of thinking of this might be that these are, if you think of the agency that Margaret overviewed, these are all of our partners sitting here at the table. These are people that we work with to get resources to the local level, to do affordable housing, to do anti-poverty programs, you know, to deliver services to Oregonians. So, the agency is, these are all separate entities working with us as a partner. So you just have different groups that are working on housing and anti-poverty initiatives and delivering services at the local and regional level sitting here at the table.
And
we have a question here from Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the our panel up here kind of winging it. I hope that doesn't discourage other people from testifying to us in the future. Two questions, if I could. First of all, to Mr. Burns, I'm looking at your map here, and I'm noticing the Oregon coast seems to be divided into five or six different regions. My own district with Lincoln City looks like it's based in Salem. I would say that that Yahats is going over to Lane County, that Coos Bay is going over to Grants Pass. Tell me a little bit about how the services reach out from those metropolitan centers into the hinterlands.
So I can speak really directly to, I used to run one of the community action agencies in Corvallis, and so part of the, if you think Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties, we had 14 different community-based facilities. So we had places in Lincoln City, we had places in Newport, Yahats, we had Head Start centers there. If you go to Corvallis, Monroe, Alcee, we had the food banks or the medical centers, and then in Lynn County. We did also try, this is years ago, to represent either the DHS or the ESD, Department of Human Services, or the Educational Service District's configuration, so we would have some joint partnerships that we could use over the years.
So the dots on your map here indicate local offices rather than just unnamed communities? Is that
correct? We tried to suggest where the facilities were in a quick visual.
All right, I'll interrupt you here because we're running short on time. I appreciate that answer. One other quick question, Madam Chair, for Mr. Wilch. I'm reading your overview here, and I see you're serving low-income families, and then in the bold you indicate that you're providing $180 million directly into the local hands and small businesses. Could you help me make that connection? How this voucher program works and how that money goes directly to local businesses?
Absolutely. We are, biggest program the housing authorities have is the Section 8 voucher program. That Section 8 voucher program is inherently works with private landlords. Private landlords will house our clients with a voucher. The housing authority pays a portion of the rent to that landlord. It's a guaranteed rent. That's the $180 million that goes out from housing authorities and
so again,
private landlords.
So again, if I could
landlord.
Interrupt, because we're short on time. So I'm hearing you very quickly. You're saying that the small business you're referring to are local landlords.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's good.
Good
Thank
question.
You.
Thank you. So does somebody want to talk with us about this?
All right,
great.
Peter Hanley, Cost Mortgage. So
you have that, Debbie? Do you have his name?
I'll give you a card.
Okay.
So it all started with the feds and USDA and HUD with these federal programs. And Department of Labor and HHS also have some money that goes into some of these housing programs. So OICS is the state organization. So then you also have some of the cities, local jurisdictions that also will provide some housing money. Now, public housing authorities, of which there are how many?
22.
Community Development Corporations are the more recent thing that were formed, started in the 80s, kind of have absorbed some of the work that the housing authorities used to do. And then the community action agencies, now the community action agencies should actually be here, but for the time, they spun off a lot of these community development corporations as some of the CAPs decided to start providing housing in some of these communities. Then you've got you got private nonprofits. You got these local CDCs.
Could you move over a little bit, Joe's representative guy?
Okay, but you got to call
it. Action program.
Okay.
CAPS.
Okay.
And our CAP friends can tell you more. Want to ask about those? We are a statewide CDC that does farm worker housing. So you've got Oregon Opportunity Network. John represents that. Community Action Partnership, which Tom represents. Oregon Housing Authorities, which Andy represents. All a little bit distinct by the types of organizations that they serve. Then you've got Neighborhood Partnerships, which is a local nonprofit. You've been introduced to them, and they basically run the Housing Alliance, which is this conglomeration of state or local cities and nonprofits and housing authorities. And you've got the local CDCs that are out in all these communities.
What's CDC?
Community Development Corporation. That's a quick rundown. I hope that's helpful.
That's great.
Watch for your guys' point of view, the timing is interesting as federal monies during the Reagan years went away. You really saw the blossoming of the CDC movement. And so you see a lot more activity happening now with these private nonprofits out in the community. The housing authorities, even a lot of the housing authorities, have spun off nonprofits to take advantage of some of the activities that these community development corporations are able to do that they can't do. So the new wave is kind of here with the local CDCs. So I think as Margaret is doing her transformation, I think she's going to be relying a lot more on these local organizations in the community, the CDCs. I'm conjecturing and I can probably leave now. So
you did great. Thank you. Perfect. Yes.
You kept mentioning CAPS.
Oh.
It's what does CAPS refer to?
Community action.
Community action programs. Okay. Or community action agencies.
Those are all poverty programs.
Okay.
Any other? Oh, we've 5 minutes left. Yes. Any other questions? This is yes.
I was wondering if someone could put together something like this so that when we are sitting here each day listening to you. Whatever day, we can sit down and figure out what we're doing by a graph, this sort of thing, visualization, so we don't get lost.
Great idea. President Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the exercise today is a demonstration of why it was so important to call out housing in a committee name and
yes.
focus on it. I'm struck by all the names on the board, by the cast of wonderful people that are advising you on a variety of different programs. And I'm thinking of something that you, I read a quote from you in the paper about who's organizing all of this. And it seems like that is a very difficult question to answer. And I wonder if there must not be a more simple way
yeah.
that
yes,
you
yeah.
could describe when writing a CEO job description. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine how to describe
right.
the work that you do and all of your responsibilities. It's pretty overwhelming.
I'll be happy to try to put this together with the help of folks. But, I think part of what you're looking at is really at an evolution from those early poverty programs in the 60s and sort of
hodgepodging things together. I mean, in the last 35 years of really conservative administrations where poverty monies simply weren't available, I mean, this is the kind of thing that just, like I said, very much an involvement of how we've tried to respond to poverty issues. And clearly, housing has become a very central part of the war on poverty as it exists today. So it'll be interesting to sort of put this together.
Great. So can that be your assignment? And
can I guess it is.
Any staff time to devote to this? And we'll work on that.
Yeah, okay.
So it's, Margaret, did you have something? Oh yeah, right.
She's voluntary.
Yeah.
Right, yes. And so we'll get as many of you folks involved as possible. Not too many, because then it becomes unworkable.
And I think what's exciting is this gives this committee an opportunity to sort of look forward as to, okay, if this is where poverty efforts have evolved, what can we look at in terms of the future? So
great. Good. Yeah. Well, thank you for being patient with us and helping us learn, us fourth graders. And I appreciate the committee for being patient too. We sort of starting at a tough place trying to grasp all this, and I think we're going to learn a lot. It's a really important issue. John, I hope you will be involved with this too. That's great. So any last words from anybody in the committee or here? All right. Thank you all. We'll hear more from you, and thank you for the materials you brought and coming to testify. All right. Oh, yes. And with that, I'll close the health services. And what